According to the U.S. intelligence community, Russia intervened in America's 2016 presidential campaign to benefit one candidate. As shocking as that revelation was, our guest this week warns it's all part of a broader pattern of Russian efforts directed against the West. She's Alina Polyakova this week on Storing the Public Square. Hello and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University, alongside my friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller from the Providence Journal. In each episode, we try to understand the dominant narratives or stories shaping American public life. This week, we turn to the international and Russia's efforts to use narrative and other devices to shape the politics of the Western world. To help us make sense of this, we're joined by Dr. Alina Polyakova, who is Director of Research for Europe and Eurasia at the Atlantic Council in Washington, D.C. Alina, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So this is a topic that has gotten a lot of attention in the press in the last 6-8 months especially. But let's start with some definitional issues just for the audience that might not be familiar with it. When we talk about political warfare, what are we talking about?
Well, that's actually a pretty old term, I would say. You know, if we're looking at the Russians specifically and going all the way back to the Soviet days, I mean, the Soviet Union was very effective and very active in the space of unconventional warfare. Some people call it hybrid warfare. Political warfare is just another term for that. It's basically the idea that war in itself is not just military versus non-military, that it is really a spectrum. And you can use other tools and methods as a state actor to prepare societies, to prepare people's attitudes, to prepare the theater, if you will, for a certain type of idea, a certain type of view of the world that then benefits a potential more military action. So in the Soviet days, for example, there are many reports that came out later about how the Soviet government funded extremist leftist groups, communist parties, political movements, even some environmental groups as a way to try to undermine politics in certain European countries. And what we're seeing today is that in many ways, the Russian government now under Vladimir Putin has picked up some of those old tools that they call active measures to do very similar things.
All right. So part of that is disinformation, which is a broad term. Tell us a little bit about what that means.
Right. So if we think about political warfare, it really involves a few different baskets of tools, if you will. Disinformation, or what the Russians call dezinformatsiya, is one of those tools. If there's others that they tried to cultivate, such as building alliances with political parties, leaders that share the Russian worldview, corruption, the export of kleptocratic networks, etc. But looking at disinformation specifically, this is something that many of us in the United States now have come to know because of our own experience in the presidential elections. And this is the practice of inserting, you could say fake news is the term du jour, lies, or even narratives that have a kernel of truth into them, into the public discourse in an attempt to try to manipulate the narrative around key geopolitical events or even political outcomes like elections.
So, you know, on the surface, you would think, and we've discussed this many times on this program, but you would think that a lie is a lie and people don't like lies and they see through lies. Well, obviously, the reality has proven quite different. Why are these measures so effective? Why does disinformation work? What is it about, you know, the American public or the human mind that gives it an opening?
Well, it's an interesting question of what does it mean when disinformation works, right? A lot of people in the United States have been questioning this entire idea of Russia's involvement in our electoral campaigns and elections more broadly, because it's hard to say that, you know, a voter average American, Idaho, Missouri, elsewhere, changed his or her mind about the person they want to support because of a news story they read or because of some information that Russia's state-sponsored media put out there. That's a really difficult connection to make. But at the same time, these things matter because how disinformation works, and this happened in the United States and it's also happening in Europe all the time, it exploits the virtues of our pluralistic media environment. And I can explain what I mean by that a little bit more. So in Western societies, unlike in places like Russia or China, other authoritarian regimes, we have a variety of news outlets. And what has happened with our new information age is, you know, everybody knows you get your media news sources from your social networks, Twitter, Facebook, wherever, and you can just repost that. So the speed with which information travels has, you know, quadrupled or has gotten through the roof, right? And on the other hand, the amounts of sources we have to get our information from has also increased exponentially. And so what state actors like Russia have been able to do is use this new media environment in an exploitative and manipulative way. And what it does do is it shapes people's minds and ideas about the world, these big ideas of how the world works. You know, who is to blame for, let's say, the conflict in Ukraine or for the war in Syria? And this is where I think the Russians particularly have been very effective in understanding how to manipulate what are real virtues in our media environment to serve their own geopolitical agenda.
So in, we want to talk, I think we're going to talk more in a little bit about the American election, but you authored a study, co-authored a study last November with some colleagues at the Atlantic Council, The Kremlin's Trojan Horses, where you describe a web of connections between Russia and political parties and civil society across Western Europe. Explain the study and its conclusions a little bit for our audience.
Right, so this particular study, I mean, to be honest with you, there was nothing, you know, crazy and new in this study. The purpose of it was to really show in a more comprehensive way that there has been a strategic move on the part of the Russian government to cultivate a network of alliances across Western European countries, countries that the United States has very close relationships with, like Germany, France, the United Kingdom, and not just in Central Eastern European countries or the former Soviet space. And what we found in that study is if we took all the information that was out there in the public space, in the public domain, what we saw is a very clear pattern of how the Kremlin has been cultivating these relationships and to what ends. And you know, we can talk a little bit about why the Russians have been doing this. It's also disinformation, I think, is a facilitating or buttressing strategy to all of this. I mean, I think they do it for a very clear reason. You know, from the Russian point of view, if you have political actors, political parties such as the National Front in France, led by Marine Le Pen, other far-right populist parties who are also very, very pro-Russian, which is a little counterintuitive, actually. There's no reason why they should be pro-Russian. They have a very nationalist agenda.
Nationalist party, right.
That's exactly right. But from the Russian point of view, you know, having a close relationship, an alliance with a party that is anti-EU, with a party that is anti-immigrant, with a party that is anti-sanctions against Russia, then that's a very valuable relationship to try to harness.
And that's the common DNA when you start looking at policy alignment between these parties across Europe. Is that a basic sketch of what we're talking about here, anti-immigrant, anti-EU, pro-Russia?
Well, I think there's a lot of variation. You know, perhaps many of your viewers and many average Americans had no idea that, you know, far-right populist parties even existed in Europe. But in fact, they've been around for a pretty long time. Marine Le Pen's National Front Party in France, one of the strongest far-right parties today, was founded many decades ago, as was the Freedom Party in Austria and others. But we have seen that is relatively new. So I think this turn towards the Kremlin among these parties, and some are pro-Russian, some are not, I think what actually unites this far-right populist moment, this movement in Europe, if we can call it that today, is that they are anti-EU political parties, and that is very much in the interest of the Russian Federation today, to have an EU that is much more destabilized, much more in a state of political paralysis than it otherwise could be.
So what is Russia's ultimate intent in all of this? What is their objective? And you could rephrase that question by saying, at what point does Vladimir Putin say, thumbs up, success, we got there? What are they trying to do?
Again, you know, there's been a lot of debates in sort of the policy circles in Washington and other European capitals on this exact question. And what is the big strategy here? And is Putin himself a strategist, or is he kind of an opportunist that takes advantage of political moments? You know, I was saying earlier that in the Soviet days, the Soviet Union was an ideological state. So when it tried to undermine European polities, it did so by supporting, you know, communist political parties and movements. And what we've seen now is that the Russian state is not ideological. So they support, actually, far-right populist parties, and they've also been known to support the leftists as well. And I think the ultimate goals here are twofold. I think the number one goal, if you're sitting in the Kremlin, is to have a government, a president in any country that is pro-Russian. If you can't get that, and instead you are faced with somebody who supports sanctions against your country for your actions in Ukraine and elsewhere, then the second order goal is to at least have a disruptive strategy where you try to support and facilitate the rise of political actors that try to undermine consensus. So I think if you can't get your first goal and have basically a puppet government, which is what Putin had in Ukraine before the revolution there in 2014, then you go for your second goal, which is to sow discontent, to destabilize, to undermine consensus, and to, I think, manufacture places of ambiguity where we don't really know what to think about world events, and we don't really know who to believe when it comes to political leaders.
Do you think there is a personal element here with Vladimir Putin? And we are not psychologists here, and we are not inside his head, but do you think there's some level of emotional reward for him, ego reward, where he is sort of sitting back and while he has these larger objectives, he is getting some sort of pleasure or reward?
You know, again, we don't really know what Putin thinks. Many people have tried to figure that out. I think certainly if you look at where he started, when he was elected to office in the year 2000 and to where he is now, it's almost been 20 years for him that he's been at the helm of Russia. He's certainly come a long way in putting Russia back on the world stage. So I think if you're Putin and you're sitting back at looking at what you've been able to accomplish in your term, then I would imagine that would be very satisfying for him. It's probably not so satisfying to the Russian people, however.
What are some of the tools that Russia is using? You've mentioned some of them, I think, but what are some of the specific media tools that Russia is using to advance its narrative and advance its interests internationally?
So what's been really interesting to observe what the Russian government has done, I think particularly since the mid-2000s, is they've invested a great deal of resources, so budget, state budget money, into developing these externally facing networks and media outlets. One major one that some people may have heard of is RT. It used to be called Russia Today.
Wide audience in the United States, Washington, D.C. in particular, every cable network.
Yes, yeah. This is the interesting. You go to a hotel, if you don't have cable at home, and you turn your television, you can get RT. Yeah. Interestingly enough, there's a lot of speculation that RT actually pays these cable providers to run their shows, which is not typical. It's usually the other way around.
Right.
But, you know, RT is just one of these networks. There's also Sputnik. It's also English language. And RT has the biggest viewership in Arabic, surprisingly enough.
That's
interesting. Which is very interesting, where, you know, they are seen as an alternative news outlet. And what's interesting about RT and other media organizations like this that the Russian government has set up is that, you know, their purpose is not to put out a great image of Russia and to make people love Russia. Because if that's the measure, then they failed. Because if we look at European attitudes, for example, Russia, as people's opinion, Russia has been declining for the last three to 4 years. But what their logo is to question more. That's their motto. So it's really about, you don't know what the truth is. You can't trust the mainstream media. You can't trust anybody. So question everything.
Right.
And this is how they manufacture this ambiguity.
The sowing skepticism. We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this program can be heard four times each weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States channel, the POTUS channel, number 124. Story in the Public Square is produced each week by a remarkable and talented crew at Rhode Island PBS. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. If you want to tweet me, I'm at JM Lutis. My co-host is G. Wayne Miller from the Providence Journal, and you can tweet him at G. Wayne Miller. And our guest this week, Director of Research for Europe and Eurasia at the Atlantic Council, is Dr. Alina Polyakova. She tweets at Alina Sphere. Alina, so what can we say if we talk specifically about some of the countries in the report and some of the countries that you study about Russia's role in the French presidential election?
So this is a really interesting moment in Europe. 2017 and 2018 is going to see many key European countries have major elections, national level elections, that could potentially dramatically change European policy and politics for years to come. So the French elections have been an interesting case to observe. I think after the experience in the United States that we had, Europeans, particularly the French and the Germans also have elections this year in the fall, have been very aware of the potential threat that these kinds of disinformation campaigns can cause in shaping their public discourses. I mean, one thing to note, we were talking a lot in the United States about cyber attacks, but what the Russians did in the United States wasn't just a cyber attack. It wasn't just that breach of somebody's email or a server. It was an influence operation, because they could have taken those documents, and that could have just been an intelligence gathering operation, but then they chose to release them publicly, and that's when this became an influence operation versus just intelligence gathering. What's interesting is in France, so far, even though the election period has been going on for a couple of months, the campaign period, we haven't seen such a massive data dump as we saw in the United States. People were warning against it. The French intelligence community clearly pointed the finger at Russia and attributed some disinformation to the Russians. The Germans have been talking about it publicly, but it's been surprising to see how little of this kind of manipulation has happened.
Is it possible, though, that this is because the French government was vocal about it? One of the criticisms I think that's emerging in the United States is that we know now from additional reporting that the Central Intelligence Agency was concerned in the early summer of 2016 about what was going on, and it wasn't until October that you got the statement from the director of DHS and the director, or the secretary of DHS and the director of national intelligence, warning it. But even there, it was sort of hedged because of concerns about appearing to try to intervene in the election itself. Is it because of the American experience and because of what the French were saying publicly, and along with the British and the Germans, mm-hmm. that has maybe more sensitized the French public, and so it's not as ripe an atmosphere?
Well, I think you're absolutely right about that. I think it's clear to me that our French French and German and other colleagues and friends in Europe have taken that lesson from the United States, that you have to speak out, that there is a value to political leadership, to Chancellor Merkel standing up and giving a national address and saying, we are facing a threat. I mean, it would be an interesting exercise to think about how things could have turned out differently if President Obama at the time had held a national press conference from the Oval Office and said, my fellow Americans, we are facing a threat to our democracy. I think this would have gone in a very different direction had it been framed along those lines versus a partisan line. But I think there's still a lot to be done. I mean, to be honest with you, the French friends and colleagues that I have in Germany as well, who are not as involved in politics, I mean, they tell me that there's actually very little public awareness, you know, outside of those who read mainstream media and really follow politics a lot, about why does any of this matter? And so I really think it's up to the political leaders in our own countries to make the case for why this matters.
So can you give our listeners and viewers just a little bit of background about the French presidential elections, and in particular, what is at stake in France with these elections?
The French elections have been fascinating. It's really an unprecedented moment in French politics because the biggest issue is that the centrist parties are collapsing. So the center-right party, the Republicans, is the party of the former president, Nicolas Sarkozy, who many of us know, have nominated a candidate, François Fillon, who has been completely mired in a huge corruption scandal. And he was the favorite to win. And now he's trailing, I think, in third place. And he's trailing in third place behind two anti-establishment candidates. On the one hand, you have Marine Le Pen, the leader of the far-right populist party. Her party has almost no seats in the French parliament, but that's sort of an idiosyncrasy of the French system. And she is now going neck to neck with the center-right, the center-left independent candidate, Emmanuel Macron, who is not running with a traditional center-left socialist party. And the socialist candidate is like fifth right now in the polls. So the French elections now, you have two candidates at the top who are anti-establishment, who are very different in their platforms, polar opposites, I would say. Macron is a pro-globalist, open society, pluralist. He likes the EU. He talks about open borders, innovation, things like that. He's very young. And then you have Marine Le Pen, who represents this far-right, say, xenophobic, anti-immigrant, nationalist agenda. And these are the two candidates that, as of right now, look like they're going to go into the second round of elections.
And significantly, the National Front, the party that Marine Le Pen leads, has received financial loans,
yes,
from Russian banks.
Exactly. I mean, again, going back to this question of what did the Russians get of cultivating these relationships and alliances? Well, now they have Marine Le Pen, who was just visiting President Putin at the end of March in the Kremlin, had a very nice photo op there, which looked very presidential.
It's really remarkable, the proximity of that meeting,
yes,
to the actual election.
Exactly. That was interesting because you had the collapse of the center-right candidate that I mentioned in this scandal, corruption scandal. Then you had the first debates. And then, you know, two or three days later, you have Marine Le Pen going to Moscow to meet with a surprise visit with President Putin. A lot of people have been speculating what this meant. I think there's a few things there. One, it made her look like a leader on the world stage. And I think, two, it showed that there is a real partnership between the Kremlin and her political party that goes beyond financial support, which certainly has been there as well.
Remarkable.
So we always like to have our audience learn a little bit more about our guests. What led you to this work? What is the journey that brought you here?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I asked myself that. How did I get into this mess?
You can make up an answer. It's the era of, you know, fake news. So.
No, but in all honesty, I became interested early on when I was a graduate student at Berkeley, and I was a sociologist, and trying to understand what was happening in Europe. People seemed to think that Europe was this old, stale continent, and it was very uninteresting, you know. Most of my colleagues wanted to study, you know, countries where there's development and conflict, like India, the Middle East, China, right? But I looked to Europe and I saw the emergence of these fledgling, very small fringe nationalist parties. And that fascinated me. And that's what I studied. And then, to be honest with you, Russia came into this for me by surprise. Just the more I tried to understand what was driving and propelling these nationalist political movements in Europe, I started to see how Russia was facilitating the rise of these movements, how they were using what were basically domestically driven political parties to their own advantage, and how they were starting to encroach upon countries in Europe to try to undermine their politics through these political actors. And so that's I think, still a very not well understood topic.
Well, so what do Western democracies and Western publics do in the face of this challenge?
That's a really complex question, I would say.
We've got about 3 minutes left.
All right. look, on the one hand, we were talking about earlier, there is, I think, an important role for political leaders to play here, to make the public aware of the threat posed by, you know, these this political warfare that not just Russia, but other states are waging against us. I mean, Russia has been the most prominent in the news, but, you know, authoritarian regimes learn from each other.
Right.
And so there are no consequences for these kinds of actions. If our political leaders are not willing to say, you know, the Russian government has interfered in our elections, and not only have they done that, they're undermining our democratic values by exploiting our open societies, by turning our virtues into vulnerabilities for them to exploit. And I mean, and some practical answers to that beyond that political leadership is, you know, we have to reinvest in an independent media space, investigative journalism. I don't think we're living in a post-truth world. I think there's a space for truth.
Amen.
You know?
Yeah.
And there are many things that our government states, European governments can do to empower civil society.
Quick question. We have seen in the wake of the American election last year a lot of citizens becoming involved in the political process, probably more so than certainly in recent election years. What can the citizen in America do on this front to help?
I think, you know, we have to be more aware of how we consume our information. I think that's one very clear thing. That puts a lot of burden on an individual when they're reading news sources. But to try to just understand, you know, and be more critical, right? Am I reading something that is a fact? Is this headline with lots of exclamation marks? Something I should believe in? Maybe I should check some other sources for this story if I'm interested. I mean, that's one clear thing you can do. I think another thing, you know, if we're talking about people who may be more active and want to get more involved, you know, I mean, I'm on PBS, so maybe I'm saying this because I'm here, but I really do believe this. I mean, support your independent media in the ways that you can. You know, don't spread it on your social media. If you can, donate to your local newspaper in your town, right? Understand that there is such a thing as standards, and not everything on the internet is the truth.
It's media literacy. It's critical thinking.
Yes.
The role of the big tech firms, Google, Facebook, have all said they're going to start trying to do something. You know, almost out of time. Optimistic or pessimistic about the effectiveness of those efforts?
I think it's incredibly challenging because they have to walk the line between privacy for their clients, their users, and on the other hand, doing what is morally and ethically right. And I think we're coming to a key battle moment between governments and the tech industry today. We've already seen some, actually, French candidates talk about this specifically, how they will wage that war.
But we've got to leave it there. Alina Polyakova, thank you so much. The study is The Kremlin's Trojan Horses, and it's available on the Atlantic Council website. If you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or visit PellCenter.org. He's G. Wayne Miller. I'm Jim Lutis. We hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Story in the Public Square.